Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 3rd of May, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, we've got Ben Rubin. Welcome to the program, Ben. And Debbie Evans by remote access, as usual. But we're going to start very quickly, just a very brief comment on the election. We'll just use the BBC to put the statistics up. Those were the statistics that were available just before we came on air. The Labour Party claiming that they've won all kinds of landslide victories. Well, the Tories may have lost 126 council seats, according to this particular statistic, but Labour only won 52. I think it's significant, Ben, that 39 independents have won 39 new seats. I think that's pretty good. And we would like to encourage more independents to stand whenever they finally, or if they stand, call the general election. Anyway, I don't think there's any more to be said about that at this stage. If there are any results for the police and crime commissioners, no doubt we'll report that on Monday, but those have not been announced just yet. But look, I wanted to comment on this article from the Daily Mail. The headline here is AstraZeneca has admitted its COVID vaccine caused the condition that killed Gareth's BBC presenter wife. So why won't he and their son see a penny in compensation? First of all, it's being described as an exclusive, and because it's exclusive, maybe they've hidden it behind the Mail Plus paywall, but nonetheless, this is about a guy called Gareth Eve and his wife, who was a BBC journalist called Lisa Shaw. Lisa passed away following vaccination with AstraZeneca. But, this article, I have to say, is an absolute disgrace. The Daily Mail is an absolute disgrace. The entire mainstream media is an absolute disgrace. And the thing is, why do I say this? Well, for two reasons. First of all, they've covered this story, but they haven't covered in any detail at all the thousands of injured or dead as a result of the jabs. But then there's this little detail from further on down the article. It says, while others, including one man who died in the same hospital ward as Lisa in the same week from exactly the same reaction to the vaccine, could be in line for compensation payments if they win in court, Gareth Eve will not. And they quote him as saying, it's because of a technicality, a loophole. I'm devastated. I feel completely abandoned all over again. It actually takes me back to just after Lisa died, when I was in that state of feeling utterly alone, thinking, well, what now? And so the basis of this is that he has been excluded from this class action because it has turned out that following or after the 7th of April 2021, and with the approval of the MHRA, a warning about the risk of thrombotic complications was added by AstraZeneca to the patient information leaflet, or at least was sent to healthcare professionals. I think it is absolutely disgraceful now that the Mail is attempting to raise money through their Mail Plus paywall by highlighting this fact, when it was the Mail in particular, along with all the other mainstream media organizations that were denying the possibility of these complications at the time and since. And Debbie, so I find this really cynical, actually, this entire article. I'm pleased that Gareth Eve and his issue is being given some publicity, but nonetheless, lots of other vaccine injured not getting any publicity. And the Mail has some questions to answer about its the fact that it did not highlight these complications at the time.
Yeah, 100%. Good afternoon, everyone. I mean, the Mail has got a lot of questions to ask, but so has everybody else got a lot of questions to ask. And let's just remember Sir Pascal Sorio, AstraZeneca, Terra Carta, Astra Carta, but also patients didn't get an information leaflet, a patient information leaflet prior to the injection. Nobody knew the adverse reactions. Even the doctors didn't know. If you remember, I received a letter from the Royal College of General Practitioners who said that doctors neither knew the ingredients of the injection or the serious adverse reactions or any adverse reactions. So informed consent was never an option. It was never on the table. And nobody was highlighting that at the time. It was an implied consent. But if viewers want to go back and look at it, this legal issue a little bit more, we did a very good interview with Peter Todd, who's been acting. He's a solicitor and he's been acting on behalf of the vaccine injured. The interview's called You're Not Alone and it's on the column. And we screened it in March 2023. And I'm going to try and get in contact with Peter to see if we can get an update on this. But clearly there is a long, long way to go, as we are going to come and see. We're going to wait and see in my next segment, which actually brings me on to the MHRA. And we will talk a bit more about AstraZeneca. So the MHRA board meeting's coming up, folks. Please, could you all page in and sign up on the, I think it's what, the 21st of May between 10 and 12:30. We've only got a couple more meetings before Dame June Rain departs. So we really want to get as many people as possible. Please register. And also really now going back to AstraZeneca and tandeming in with your story, Mike, on AstraZeneca. And there are two sides, as we know, to the vaccine miracle. And Jamie Scott, who was fit and healthy before the jab, is now not so fit and healthy. And he is actually suing AstraZeneca. So there are some of them that are still taking legal action. But can I just remind you, Matt Hancock, what did he say about the AstraZeneca vaccine?
The Oxford AstraZeneca jab is safe. We know that over 10 million people have had it in this country. And that's what the British regulator says, but also the World Health Organization and even the European regulator. Now, we keep the effects of these vaccines under review all the time, and we know that the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is saving lives in the UK right now. So if you get the call, get the jab.
Really, Matt? Really? Thank you to Kenny for finding me that clip. And finally, on this little segment, Victoria Atkins, it would appear, didn't get the memo. Her aides let her down. She didn't snub the COVID vaccine victims. She just didn't get the memo. Well, you know now, Victoria. So when's the meeting? Do let us know.
Yes, that's a very good question. Well, what can we say about that? We'll have much more on this in coming days and weeks, I'm sure. Ben, let's move on to My Life, My Say.
Absolutely, yes. Yet again, we're talking about My Life, My Say. United we stand, divided we fall, is the phrase. And we are more divided now than at any other time in our nation's history. We're pitting the young against the old. We're pitting women against men, religion against religion, race against race. And this is entirely by design. Who benefits? Tyrannical powers. Who sits at the centre of this stuff? Well, organisations like My Life, My Say, and the entities that surround it. This UK youth charity, ostensibly a non-partisan effort to get young people involved in politics, is extraordinarily well linked into the senior levels of the establishment. It has relationship with the Tony Blair Institute, with Sadiq Khan, the US Embassy, MI6, One Young World, another youth charity, which is whose patron is Meghan Markle, NCS, the National Citizen Service, whose chairman is Lord Cameron, our Foreign Secretary, UK Youth, whose patron is Princess Anne, R&Co Four Generations, which is the Rothschild family based out of Paris, Tortoise Media, which is a new media organisation which works directly with the Rothschild family, and My Life, My Say sits in the centre of all of this. It's run by this gentleman, Mehdi Choban, MBE. He got his MBE for getting young people into politics. That's ostensibly what this organisation is here to do. It's got a board of trustees, as all charities do. I won't go through all of them right now, but the one that's particularly interesting, given what we've already been talking about, what's going on this week and this year, is this woman, Harjeet Sahota, who is the head of external relations and stakeholders for Keir Starmer at the UK Labour Party. And according to, in her own words, her job is about directing the electoral and targeting strategy for community engagement for the UK 2024 general election. That's what she's there to do. She's trying to get that fella on the right-hand side of the stage into power, which will ultimately mean that the guy on the left-hand side of the stage, Tony Blair, will be in power, because that's ultimately, I believe, who Starmer is working for. It's not very non-partisan, is it? So we spoke about them a couple of weeks ago. We talked about My Life, My Say a lot over the past few months. Mehdi Choban was extremely excited because the charity had done a great job, actually, of getting people, young people, signed up to vote on as part of their Give an X campaign. And we've already reported on this. The reason that it's interesting, and I'm bringing it back up today, is that we're actually seeing the confluence of two stories. We talked about MLMS a lot. We've also talked about Freud Communications, Freud's group. And it turns out that those two organizations are working together. This was an announcement made a couple of days ago by Freud's. My Life Might Say, a non-partisan youth-led charity, is campaigning to increase voter participation through the Give an X campaign. With our support, so they are working together, more than 113,000 young people registered on National Voter Registration Day. All right, so these two things are actually the same thing. And let's remind ourselves what Freud's are up to. Amongst other things, they run Gold's House, the diverse community of business and political leaders, activists, NGOs and entrepreneurs focused on delivering the UN Sustainable Development Goals. They've got a big advisory board. And they're not just running Gold's House as a client, they are actively and intimately involved in it. So Matthew Freud, you can see in the top right-hand side there with the buzz cut and the green accent behind him. He is the chair of Gold's House and also a director of the Sustainable Development Goals. So he was actually involved in defining them and running out that entire program. Let's remind ourselves a bit about Gold's House. We talked about this a lot, particularly back in January around Davos. This is James Harding, the Tortoise editor, stood in front of a tapestry of Satan. This is the Grace and Perry Walthamstow tapestry, which we subsequently found out actually hangs in the Freud's office. Yeah, so that's probably owned by Matthew Freud, and they take it around with them to go to these meetings. Who else was at Gold's House? This was from 2023. We have Jane Goodall there in the center, who earlier that day had sat on stage and said that we needed to reduce the global population by 95%. And then she went to Gold's House and she was hanging out with Brian on the left there. He's not the king, he's a very naughty boy. And the global climate czar, Al Gore. Now, what are they doing? They are delivering these, the UN Sustainable Development Goals, or as I like to call them, the Unsustainable Development Goals. You can't be implemented, they don't make any sense. And to show that these two things are linked, not least because of what Freud's announced in the piece that I showed a couple of slides back, they've actually put the 17 colours of the Sustainable Development Goals across the top of each of these images, so you can see that they are, in fact, one and the same thing. Yeah, they are signalling to us that this is SDG-related activity. Yeah, it's all tied together. And who's it focused on? It's all focused on young women. Yeah, it's absolutely squarely focused on young women. In particular, it's young immigrant women, and with a particular focus on young Muslim women, right? So this is divisive in a number of different ways, yeah? And they're doing this in the context of what they're describing as the squad. And you'll be familiar with that term because of Alexandria Occasional Cortex, I can't remember how to pronounce the name, and Ilhan Omar and the other hard left-wing Democrat US politicians who've been pushing this kind of agenda for the past, well, it's probably a decade now, isn't it?
Can I just say on the squad, it very much reminds me of Common Purpose, because it's leadership training,
yes,
in this case for young people, but it's also an alumni network in the background as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And what's really interesting is they're actually scrubbing this information from the website at the moment. So actually, I was going to say at the start, all of the partners who were formerly listed on the website, so the MI6 and the US Embassy and those organizations, they've actually been removed over the past few weeks from the site. So they're cleaning this up in this important election year. And they've also removed all the references to the squad as well. So they're kind of covering up their methods. They're doing this in the context of basically a global gender war, right? I mean, it's been going on for a long time, but there's been a lot of discussion over recent weeks of a global gender divide that's emerging.
But I'm sure it's just happening naturally. There's nobody behind it. It's not a conspiracy.
It's completely organic, Mike. Of course, this is just emanating up from the ether. Like, there's nothing behind it at all. But it is quite a remarkable split. And it's all down the middle between male and female. And what we're seeing is that women are much more liberal than men, much more likely to vote for left-wing parties than men. And as you say, it's not naturally occurring. It's being driven by the actions taken by organizations like MLMS, Freud Communications, Tortoise Media. Basically, the whole mainstream media, the entire cultural narrative has been geared up to deliver this divide. Yeah, just a yet another divide. We talked about the young and the old, talked about gender divide. We talk about the religious dynamic they've introduced into this, but also it is about race. And actually the last time I think we spoke about My Life, My Say was that to highlight that Dr. Shola Mosh Shagbimimu, Bagbimimu, yeah, I think I got that right, actually spoke at their launch event interestingly. And she's a big critic of Israel, apart from she probably isn't a big critic of Israel behind closed doors, because she was quite happy to go along to this this launch event back in 2021 to talk alongside Reverend Al Sharpton. And Al Sharpton is one of the biggest race grifters of the past 50 years, basically, you know, extremely divisive figure in the United States. And you can see him here arriving into the UK to meet Lord Simon Woolley of Woodford, which is where I live. So he's my lord, I suppose. And he's now actually principal of Homerton College in Cambridge, where he's personally leading efforts to further radicalise students. And we can see him here speaking at the Cambridge Union last week.
I want to take you back 30 years, if I may, because 30 years ago, I was an up-and-coming activist fighting for social and racial justice with Operation Black Vote. Back then, there were 4 black, Asian and minority ethnic MPs. Now, there are 64. Black and brown cabinet and a brown prime minister. That's the good news from 4 to 64. The bad news, I think you know where I'm going to go with this, not all our skin folk are our kin folk. You know, actually, joking aside, it breaks my heart, as a matter of fact, to see black and brown faces standing on the cliffs of Dover, saying to the most vulnerable people on the planet, "We don't want you."
So according to Lord Woolley, your skin colour should define your political opinions. Yeah. And he is actually one of the most active and one of the worst dividers in the country at the moment. And we're going to see these intersectional fault lines between races, religions, genders, the different generations in the country, opened up as much as possible by these people this year. And it's our job as concerned and active and engaged citizens to put the pieces back together and to unite the country.
With a view to a clash of civilizations, perhaps. But anyway.
Well, we should see.
Let's see. Yes. Okay, let's move on. If you like what the UK Column does, you'd like to support us, the options to help us out are at support.ukcolumn.org. We can only do this with your assistance. So thank you to everybody that has helped us. If you can join that group, then please do so. You could share material you find on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. And don't forget, we have lots of stuff on the shop for you to have a look at if you would like to. Now, a quick reminder that yesterday's interview on mind control with Jason with Christoph went out 1 p.m. That is now, the archive of that is on the UK Column website if you'd like to go and have a look at it. And on Sunday evening this week, beginning at 4 p.m., we have a symposium on the World Health Organization entitled Rushed Pandemic Agreements, Who Benefits, with David Bell, Sylvia Berendt, and several others. So do join us for that, 4 p.m. on Sunday. And then the talk that I'm contributing to in Steyning in Southeast England, that's 10:30 a.m. Saturday the 11th of May 2024. Sandy Adams will be speaking at that. That's called Western Empire and the Great Reset. If you can join us there, it's a fiver on the door. You'd be very, very welcome. Now, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Matt Campbell and Piers Robinson, but we'll speak to Matt first. Welcome back to the UK Column, Matt. Now, you have been on to talk about particularly your brother, who passed away in the North Tower on September the 11th, 2001. And you've been aiming to get an inquest reopened into that death for quite a long time now, and being rebuffed fairly firmly by the establishment. What's the update? Because the last time you were on, you were attempting to raise money to bring further court action. Give us the update and where you're at with it.
Yeah, so we did a crowd funding appeal, which probably lasted about 6-7 weeks, and we managed to raise sufficient funds in order to challenge the Attorney General's decision through the process of a judicial review. So we had a deadline of the 3rd of April to submit the file and apply for judicial review, which we made. Because it's actually quite a complicated case and there's a lot of supporting documents, we are actually still in the process of filing additional documents. So that should be finished next week. And then the Attorney General has about 3 weeks to respond as to whether they are going to, you know, stand by their decision and let the court make a decision as to whether judicial review hearing would be held. And so, yeah, apart from us just finishing off the final submission next week, by the end of May, we will know, you know, which path the Attorney General wants to take, whether they're going to capitulate, whether she's going to capitulate and essentially sign a consent order saying, you know, we back down, or whether they're actually going to, you know, say we're going to meet you in court.
So that's where we're at right now. Yeah. So where does that decision lie? Does that it, if the attorney, it's the Attorney General's decision to decide where, how to act, and depending on how they, how she reacts, you will then, it will then go to court for judicial review. Can she block that process?
No. So essentially, because we've served, we filed at court, and well, we will complete the filing next week. They have to, within 21 days, do what's called an acknowledgement of service, which is essentially, if they wish to meet us in court, as it were, they have to respond with their own grounds as to why they think their decision that they made to deny the reopening of my brother's inquest was a lawful one. At that point, it's then in the High Court's moment for them to make the decision as to whether we are actually able to judicially review the decision that the Attorney General has made. So it is a kind of two-step process at the moment, which is, you know, once we finish the filing, the Attorney General is going to make a decision as to whether to just, you know, throw the towel in, or whether she's actually going to, you know, meet us in court potentially. And that's, I said, if the High Court judges agree that the decision can be judicially reviewed.
And so if that agreement is made and you do get to go to judicial review, how long will that process take?
My understanding is from when the Attorney General responds with the acknowledgement of service and they have to submit their own grounds, we're talking probably a couple of months for the High Court to make a decision as to whether the judicial review would go ahead or not. And if it was to go ahead, they would set a hearing date, which would probably be another, you know, 2 months down the line from that point. So we're probably talking about, if a hearing's to go ahead, you're probably talking about sort of September timeframe, which oddly enough, obviously, is going to be around the anniversary time.
Right. And in the judicial review process itself, would you be required to present some of the new evidence that you feel needs to be heard in the final inquiry, what's the decision going to be based on?
It's mainly points of law rather than the actual evidence. I mean, it's obviously part of our grounds for arguing that the Attorney General's made an unlawful decision. But I mean, essentially, it's looking at, did they, from the High Court's position, did the Attorney General correctly apply the various tests they're supposed to apply, and was their decision lawful? So we're actually really attacking, you know, was it a lawful decision that they made within the powers that the Attorney General has? You know, so it does involve the new evidence, but at this phase, it's more focusing on the legal decision making of the Attorney General.
Yeah, and I mean, Matt, just to finish off, I mean, you have shown incredible tenacity and determination in this, and I think it's a great demonstration of what's required in these types of situations. In fact, in any kind of situation of this type, you just got to keep going, and so you are making progress at this stage.
I mean, yes, you've got to keep going. I mean, it's lawfare. I think they try and push things out. It's just the way a lot of these kind of cases go. That's not to say that we should be winning on paper at every single stage. We shouldn't have to keep fighting, but unfortunately, you know, that's what we're having to do here. You know, is it positive? Well, the first refusal that the Attorney General gave us last summer, you know, we did a similar process. We applied, we were preparing to apply for judicial review. served the grounds on the Attorney General. And, you know, to the extent that they just went, ah, we're going to lose. And they, within their rights, made another decision, which again, they've said no. But to be honest, the grounds that, or the reasoning they've put in their very sort of brief letter isn't much better than what they gave us in September before. So, you know, I have every confidence that, you know, on paper, we win this, which is obviously why we're taking it to court in the first place.
Yes.
Oh. Taking it to court, just saying.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, I mean, we wish you all the best with it and so on. But Piers, let's welcome you to the program. And at the weekend, there will be a showing of Peace, War and 9/11 featuring Graham McQueen, who passed away some time ago. But you will be attending and Matt will be attending as well to take part in a Q&A.
Yes, that's correct. International Center for 9/11 Justice, as part of the essentially the commemorations of Graham's passing last year, we've got a whole series of events. There's one in Boston. There's this event in Bath, and the film Peace, War on 9/11 was directed by Ted Walter, who's in charge of IC911, International Center for 9/11 Justice, and the film documents essentially the life and the work of Professor Graham McQueen. He's one of the key researchers in the field of essentially 9/11 truth, it's sometimes labeled, but essentially the academic research community who were courageous enough to actually engage with what had happened on 9/11. And of course, Graham did powerful work on the anthrax attacks, which occurred immediately after 9/11, which were connected to 9/11 as part of that deception. And so it's a brilliant film. It's a very powerful, very moving film. And we'll be screening that at the Chapel Arts Centre in Bath. Doors open at 6:30. And then we have got built around the film. I'll be giving a talk at the start just for 20, 25 minutes to the audience, essentially about the work of the International Center for 9/11 Justice. We're an organization who is involved in essentially generating new research in relation not only to 9/11, but also to the broader issue of propaganda and deception and what I call structural deep events, including COVID-19. And so we're an organization set up to do research, also to support, as we are with the Campbell family, legal moves by families trying to get justice and accountability for 9/11. And we're also involved with essentially educating the public about the body of knowledge which has been established over the last 20 years on what happened on 9/11. And so I'll give a little bit of a talk about what we're doing in IC911 to the audience, and then just spend 10, 15 minutes really running through the parallels between 9/11 and COVID-19. These are what I, in sort of academic terminology, call structural deep events, but these are events which are instigated, manipulated by elites for political purposes in a very big way. And so I'll be talking about, you know, through some of the parallels that there are between the two events. You know, we have hidden agendas, some not quite so hidden agendas, especially in the case of COVID-19. We have large volumes of propaganda. We have instigation of events, criminal activity, the involvement of the deep state or the intelligence services. And I'll be mapping out some of these parallels that there are between the two. And this is based on what I'm doing at the moment for the International Center of 9/11 Justice. And then once we'll have the screening, I think starting at 7:30 with the film, and then in the closing half hour, 45 minutes after the film, we'll have a Q&A session, which will primarily be people will ask me questions, but it's really orientated at Matt and for Matt to talk to the audience about the legal process, the legal battle that he's involved in, and then going into some of the details. So, you know, we're hoping it's going to be a good, a friendly evening. It'll be nice to sort of meet people if people can make it out to the Chapel Arts Centre in Bath. That's essentially all I have to say, and just to encourage people to come along. I think you have the details for the event on your website. I've got it on my Twitter. Top of my Twitter feed is an advert for the event and so on, so people can readily find out where it is and so on.
Absolutely. So it's on screen at the moment, and then we will have it details in the show notes after the program. So Piers and Matt, thank you very much for joining us. Matt, congratulations on the progress you're making. We hope you have success in the coming weeks, and we'll let everybody know as this story develops. So thank you both for joining us today. Okay, let's move on. And Debbie, let's have a chat about plundering state assets with public-private partnerships.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I think this segment will probably apply to most places on the globe. But in particular, if you happen to be watching in Europe, the USA, UK here, and Commonwealth countries, please take special note, because we seem to have got used to the words world government, because we seem to be ruled by a world government already, right? Climate change, sustainable goals, sustainable initiatives, public-private partnerships. These terms just slip off the tongue, don't they? But what do they actually mean? And what is actually going on in plain sight? And you don't have to go far. Just go back to the UK Column website. And I found this extraordinary article. I really would recommend everybody goes and looks at this. It's only very short, but it really is ahead of its time. Martin Edwards, Plundering State Assets with Public-Private Partnerships. And this was published in 2010. So this is how way back and how far ahead the UK Column were. So let's look at this in more detail, because Martin was spot on right. If we go back to the Treasury and we look at 2012, you can see there that education, when it comes to public-private partnerships, education have 160 plus projects, and the Department of Health with 118, Scottish Government with 80 plus, and right at the bottom with under 20 is arts, culture, media and sport. Now, thank you so much to Martin Edwards's article, and also to one of our viewers in Australia, Peter, you'll know who you are, thank you so much, who introduced me to Joan Vion. Now, Joan Vion sadly died in 2010. She was remarkable, way before her time. And in 1994, she was a businesswoman who went to a UN conference on population and development in Cairo in Egypt. And she saw through the veil and then went on to attend 103 United Nations conferences. She also formed the Women's International Media Group. She's absolutely extraordinary. Have a listen to what she says about PPP.
The real bottom line of a public-private partnership is to take control of the assets of government, local government, county government, municipal government, state government, and even federal government.
To take control of assets. This is an asset transfer. Now, I'm going to give you a quick whistle-stop tour through just a few pages that you can find on the net regarding public-private partnerships. So first of all, Open Democracy, they published this article back in 2019, how the United Nations is quietly being turned into a public-private partnership, a new agreement with the World Economic Forum. So let's go to the World Economic Forum next, and you can see that they're looking at climate change, what a surprise. And also there you've got your G20 global smart cities. Those are just two of the many papers that you'll find on the WEF. Then we go to McKinsey. So McKinsey are up to their necks in, we'll call it PPP to save time, public-private partnership, at the highest level. And they go on, actually, to talk about the four Ps. So we're no longer at the three Ps, but now we've added an extra P, which is philanthropic. So we have them collaborating with the WEF as well. They have a sustainability 4P model. And if you see in the next slide, you can see what are the 4P models. Well, that's power, agriculture, forestry, and land conservation. But what do our governments say about PPPP or PPP? Well, there you can go and find a basic introduction for non-specialists, and they give you a bit more information going on in the document, and they say that it's a significant value. Of course it is. But you can see down at the bottom there, I've highlighted it. Please freeze the screen and read all of it. I won't read it out. But at the bottom it says, a government transfers the exclusive rights to a private operator or investor to develop and or operate an infrastructure facility under certain conditions for a fixed period of time. So what kind of projects are we actually talking about? Well, if we go to the Infrastructure and Projects Authority and look at their annual report on major projects, this was just 2022 to 2023. So I just did the next slide really is just a very quick look at an overall picture. Please go to the report and look if you want to see in more detail. But you've got fleet solid support, Her Majesty's Prison, Five Wells, new prison, rapid charging fund for electric vehicles, national law enforcement program. I'm sure Charles will be covering more of that in the future, and contact engagement programs. And this isn't just government, this is local government too, as Joan Vion was saying. This is every form of government, whichever country you're in. And here is something just to back that up, local government. So you can see here we've got public-private partnerships driving growth, building resistance. But if we go back to Margaret Thatcher, and I do go back to Margaret Thatcher often, if we look at page 639 of her book, we can see that she says that with regards to water privatisation, which many of you will remember, I'm sure, back in the 80s, too much science funding going towards defence. The government were funding research which could and should have been left to industry. And as a result, there was a tendency for the research effort to universities and scientific institutes to lose out. I was convinced this was wrong. So let's go back to the WEF and look for their Global Water Initiative. And we can see, yep, there we go, a public-private partnership. But let's take you back to the amazing Joan Vion. What does she say? And pay attention, water.
Atlanta, Georgia cannot afford to restructure, revamp their sewage system. And therefore, they go to the people, the citizenry, and they say, we're going to have to raise your taxes X amount of dollars in order to be able to afford to restructure, revamp the sewer system. The citizenry says, we already pay too many taxes. We refuse to do this. And so they go back to the drawing board. And then, amazingly, they will come up with some innovative idea. You always look for that word, innovative. And sure enough, as you read through, they will talk about how, for example, Boeing Corporation is going to partner with the city of Atlanta and the state of Georgia to help with their sewer system. And of course, the Nature Conservancy or the Sierra Club or one of them is going to come along as a non-governmental organization to help. And so pretty soon, what really happens is the sewer system, which belongs to the taxpayers of Atlanta, Georgia, is transferred to this new partnership, which is comprised of Boeing and the city of Atlanta and the state of Georgia and the Sierra Club to help the citizens get a new sewer system. Now, what happens in a public-private partnership besides the transfer of that asset? Well, the little old lady who receives her sewer bill goes into shock and calls up and says, I'm sorry, I can't afford this.
And that's what you're seeing right in front of your eyes, a very stealthy transfer of public assets into private hands. So how prophetic, the water companies. Well, let's go back to The Guardian. Was it such a good idea that we had privatisation of the water companies? Plenty of secrets to be told. But Water UK, actually, their report seems to think that everything in the garden is completely rosy. I would have a few things to say about that. They say that the service has improved and that bills have remained low. I would disagree with that, but that's just one example. But let's just finish on my favourite topic, healthcare. So, of course, in healthcare, we have plenty of public-private partnerships, and no more so than a big history of public-private partnerships. This all started off in 1991 and has finished recently in 2016 with this massive $1.1 billion contract buying out Barts and the London Hospital with private contracts. And of course, now it's still going on. We've got KPMG winning the role in the NHS Federated Data Platform with Palantir. And let's just end on the World Health Organization, because of course, they are full of PPPs or PPPPs. And of course, if we look at the stakeholders and the contributors, there you go, Bill and Melinda Gates, number two. So PPPs, world government, one in the same.
Yes, indeed. And well, let's bring ourselves then back to the wonderful Mark Carney, who, of course, was governor of the Bank of England for many years. He's gone back to Canada, where he's from, and he was giving a speech last week at the Canada 2020, a time to build economic look ahead dinner in Toronto. So that's pretty exciting. Now, just to put this in a little bit of context, if you remember, once he had left the Bank of England, he started talking about climate. And he started appearing at all the various COP meetings and saying things like this: we will not get to net zero in a niche. It requires a whole economy transition. So as a sort of leader in financial affairs, he's talking about transitioning the whole economy. Not what to, we're not sure. But he went on to say that companies that don't adapt, including companies in the financial system, will go bankrupt without question. So anyway, at this Canada 2020 event a few days ago, he was talking about net zero. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
Which brings me to the second rewiring, which is this energy transition, the net zero transition. This is much bigger and moving even faster than most realize. A few years ago, businesses around the world invested 50 cents in clean energy for every dollar they put into fossil fuel energy. Now they invest 2 in clean energy for every dollar in fossil fuel energy. $2 trillion in clean right now. And that ratio is only going to continue to grow because being low carbon is now a fundamental driver of competitiveness. And it's a dynamic that's being reinforced by the AI revolution. And on that last point, I'll just give one fact. The explosion in AI computing power is driving the top 4 US tech companies, and I'll just take the top 4, their power demand, which is all clean power demand, this year is greater than the generating capacity of Sweden, and it's only going to increase. Now, so make no mistake, the global economy is in a new regime, but the laws of economics haven't changed. And as a consequence of that, the world's prone to higher and more volatile inflation, higher interest rates, not just today, but over the medium term, and new drivers of productivity. And there are other laws. Since debts must be repaid and investors rewarded for taking risks, governments that spend too much and invest too little will eventually pay a heavy price.
So it's not just companies and banks that are going to go bankrupt. It's governments as well. They're going to bankrupt governments that don't do the right thing. And the right thing, as far as he is concerned, is to be jumping on the net zero bandwagon and so on. But he wasn't worried about telling lies in his speech. So let's listen to a second short clip here.
Some right-wing populists that see current anxieties as an opportunity to stoke anger, because anger is what's necessary for their project. After all, people don't demolish things when they're positive or optimistic. I know this. I know this from my time in the UK, where for years the rallying cry of Brexiters was Broken Britain. And their solution to take back control was actually code for tear down your future. So while Brexiters promised that they were going to create Singapore on the Thames, the Truss government actually delivered Argentina on the Channel. Broken Britain. Does that sound familiar? When politicians claim our great democracies are broken, it's not because they want to fix them. It's because they want a license to demolish.
So we'll talk about much more about this in extra, because that was just spectacular. But look, he said with a straight face that the Truss government turned Britain, destroyed Britain. The Truss government wasn't in government for long enough to do anything.
About 3 weeks.
So this is a complete lie, but his position there. But anyway, we'll talk more about that in extra. But on a related topic then, let's put this on screen, because we've talked about Anthropy and we've talked, I mean, that place, the name escapes me, the Eden Project.
The Eden Project.
It's the most anti-human place I think I've ever been to, actually. But we can talk about that in extra as well.
Well, yeah, quite. And I mean, you say a related topic, everything we're talking about today is related. All of this stuff links together. The global PPP needs to touch down in the nation state. How does it touch down in the nation state? Through organizations like Anthropy. We talked about it last week, right? And we'll be talking about it a lot more, because they're gearing up this year. They describe themselves as a Davos on sea. I'm bringing them back into the mix because on the back of the big launch event we spoke about last week, they've just announced their Anthropy Alliances. So these are new national thematic and regional leadership alliances to lead organizations into implementing, turning the philosophy into action and impact, right? So they've got a global philosophy, a public-private partnership. How do they actually put that into the system? They do it through people, through relationships, through organizations. I'll just touch on a few of these here so that they jumped out at me. The first one, children and education, is being represented by Ben Fletcher, who's chief financial officer and transformation director at the Very Group, which is Littlewood's catalogues, yeah, which is basically it's a financial services company, actually, because people buy that stuff on credit, you know, ridiculous APR. And it's also owned by the Carlyle Group, who were the primary beneficiary of the war in Iraq, yeah, alongside Halliburton. Yeah, so that's who we've got thinking about children and education. Who else have we got on here? Ray Newton Smith, the chief executive of the Confederation of British Industry. So this is an extraordinarily high-powered and well-connected group of people. You've got Professor Jürgen Meyer, CBE. There's a lot of CBEs, MBEs, OBEs as part of Anthropy within their network. He runs the Northern Powerhouse Partnership. All right, so George Osborne's big push to basically create a mega city in the north. He's running it. He actually talks on his LinkedIn profile about personally being invested in delivering the fourth industrial revolution. He actually says that publicly. He's looking after infrastructure. There's a guy from NatWest in the mix there as well. And then also, interestingly, particularly given what we've just heard from Mark Carney, my former colleague, Rob Dopel, managing partner for sustainability at EY, is looking after climate and natural places. And we've got a little short clip for him from him talking, which we're going to show you now.
I think CFOs have got such a critical role to play around keeping sustainability front and center for the organization. Basically, all decisions in an organization, all capital decisions, all spend decisions, all flow through finance. And I think finance have the responsibility of ensuring that those decisions are made, not just looking at, you know, financial outcomes, but looking at much broader outcomes. Because the stakeholder environment has changed. The expectations have changed of organizations. What are you doing for society? What are you doing for climate? What are you doing for people, et cetera? And I think CFOs, therefore, have got a responsibility to ensure that that decision-making process and how they provide decision support to the business incorporates a broader set of measures than just pure financial.
All decisions go through finance. Right, if you worked in a company, small, big, whatever it might be, in a well-run business, all the decisions go through finance. It's the perfect place to apply a control mechanism. That's what Rob DePell's talking about. That's what EY are doing. It's what they're promoting to their clients. And that's why Mark Carney is so confident that companies that don't do what they're told are going to go bust, right? Because they've basically embedded this right into their governance. Final point on Anthropy. I've been thinking about the word this week. This is an interesting word. They've obviously constructed it from somewhere. Let's look at the etymology. So philanthropy itself means love of humankind. And the word phil, the first syllable in philanthropy, comes from the Greek word philos, which means dear or beloved. So anthropy is simply philanthropy without love and affection. Yeah. And I think that tells you everything that you need to know about what's happening here.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Now, on Wednesday's program, we were talking about the King's Speech and particularly two pieces of legislation, but one of them was the Investigatory Powers Amendment Bill. So just wanted to remind everybody that one of the main targets for that was encryption. So why am I mentioning it again today? Because Reclaim the Net here has published this article: leak, EU governments impose bulk scanning orders on encrypted messaging services. So just think about that, bulk scanning orders, because we kind of have the same thing with the online safety bill and related legislation in the UK. But the article says this. It says, yet another leaked document has emerged revealing details from the European Union policy regarding on the implementation of the child sexual abuse regulation. So again, this not just in, you know, Pierce is talking about structural deep events. This is a structural deep event because this is happening right across the world in different jurisdictions. So we have child abuse, the excuse of child abuse being used to shut down freedoms on the internet in every Western country at the moment. So if we put that back on screen for a second, let's have a look at the document itself. Here it is. The website Context put it up. They received a leak. And what they're basically saying is in this document from the EU that if you're running a chat, an online chat service, some kind of encrypted service for customers online, you will be scored. And if you get a low score, you would be subject to your content being given one of these orders to have your content being scanned. So low score would mean would be caused by any encryption service which does not require a user account to use. And the example that I gave on Wednesday was the VPN service Mulvad, which allows you to put a piece of put cash in an envelope and send it to them and get access to the service without any requirement to explain who you are and so on. So this would be a completely anonymous service, and this is really dangerous as far as the EU is concerned. On the other hand, they say that you would get a high score if you were a chat service, for example, that doesn't encrypt by default. For example, and this is my example, Telegram. So they would not require an order because they're already open to surveillance and bulk data collection. So it is just very interesting. I just wanted to highlight this point. This is not something that's just happening in the UK. It's happening right across the world. And therefore, we need to view, in my opinion, view it as a deep structural event. And consider it accordingly. Okay, let's move on then, Debbie. And what are we talking about here? Bill Gates is back in the picture.
Oh, don't spoil my surprise, Mike. We've got a new dish on the agenda. I know you're going to be talking about food again in a minute, but we've got a new dish. Imagine this. Imagine growing a crop. You don't need rain. It can be planted in sandy soil or desert soil. And it's considered actually the cereal of the poor. Well, it's coming to us, or it might be coming to us. This is Fonio, or as Stephanie has kindly nicknamed it, Fony. So could Fonio be a grain older than the wheel, be the future of the food? And just to let you know, it's the women that do the farming on this. Women do 50% of the work and men do 14%. I'm not quite sure who does the difference. But yeah, Bill Gates is getting really excited about it. And you can crush it. You can make it into porridge as well. Lovely bowl of porridge here. Or perhaps you want to call it gruel. So let's have a look at Bill Gates getting terribly excited about this. He's cooking, he's got the chefs, but even better, he's produced a little video. Have a little look. Trigger warning. Well, if you don't fancy eating it, don't worry, you can brew with it. So Fonio is being actually used in the UK, because Thornbridge Brewery and Guinness have already signed up, because, of course, it grows so well in drought areas. Perhaps that means we're going to have a drought, I'm not sure. But you can see there that you've also got Guinness, you've got Thornbridge, you've got all sorts of people, including Carlsberg, taking part in this. However, this isn't such good news. I'm not sure Sir Bill hasn't done all of his homework, because if he'd have gone to the Advisory Committee on Novel Foods and Processes, let's not forget the word novel means new. They've got other thoughts, and they're not too happy about Fonio. Now, I've just taken a few screenshots, and I'm just going to Stephanie's just going to run through them and you can read them at your leisure. But basically what the Food Advisory Committee is saying is that there are no health benefits that they can see. There's not enough information. The water quality is going to be monitored because they have got no clue of the sustainability of it for transportation and distribution. It could also affect thyroid activity. So the significant conclusion was actually that there was no conclusion and it doesn't seem to be safe or a good bet for a European diet. So perhaps Sir Bill wants to go back and do his homework. But I must say, Sir Bill has just had to sell two of his yachts because apparently now he's at the bottom of the top billionaires list. Just saying.
Yes. Okay. Maybe we shouldn't say that. Okay. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you for that. But sticking with food, of course, let's bring Full Fact on screen because Full Fact some time ago was very, very keen to tell us that Agenda 2030 will not enforce eating insects, banning cars, or a global dictatorship. So insects are not on the menu, right? Mainstream media telling us this as well. This is the Independent, New World Order, how the right wing became obsessed with eating bugs. Then we've got Bloomberg here, want flies with that. EU critics have a new conspiracy theory. So it's all conspiracy theories, except that the BBC is carrying this today, or yesterday, in fact. The insect farmers turning to AI to help lower costs. And they were talking about this organization. Well, this is one of the organizations. Sorry, this is one of the organizations they're talking about here, if I can get this to play properly. Full Circle, who are providing bugs to be used in animal feed. So the bug food is going to pigs and it's also going to shrimps. So, you know, we might not be eating it directly, but we're certainly eating food which has been eating that type of protein. And this is one of a growing number of biotech organizations that are developing mechanisms for growing bugs in factory formats. And they're wanting to lower their costs by bringing AI into the picture as well. So, you know, all the people that are shouting that there's nothing in this bug eating story, they might want to look again at the situation. But related in a certain sense is genomics. Because, and the reason I say that, of course, is because what's behind all this, aside from Bill Gates, is the gene editing idea, which the UK passed legislation for. But what's the latest on Genomics England?
Well, just to remind people, Genomics England is the jewel in the crown of the UK government's genetic engineering strategy. It's a data platform. It's going to house the genetic sequences of the entire population. They've already got about 5 million people on there. It's been running since the 2012 Olympic Games. It's actually part of the legacy of the Olympic Games, I think, which tells you everything you need to know about those Olympics. It's fundamental to the UK life sciences vision, right? So this is 2021, the Boris Johnson Life Sciences Vision. It describes a digital technology platform as health system, and it has Build Back Better written all over it. It's absolutely aligned to the World Economic Forum strategy. They're getting the whole population on board, as I said, including right the way down to newborn and even in vitro as well, they're talking about. Right, but don't worry, there are sensible people inside the organisation, absolutely laser focused on ethics, and I'm going to introduce you to the head of ethics right now.
Everyone's heard of ethics, but what is it? I'm Will Navoyi, I'm head of ethics operations here at Genomics England. Ethics is a branch of philosophy. For me, ethics is the difference between can and should, and the law will dictate what we can and can't do. But just because you can do something, it doesn't mean you should do it. In medical ethics, we have four pillars, and those are justice. Justice is about fairness, it's about equity, and equity is thinking about different people having different circumstances and perhaps needing more of something in order to get an equal outcome. Then there's autonomy, so that's giving people a choice and then respecting that choice. In medical ethics, everything is dictated by consent. Then there's beneficence, and what that is making sure that everything we do is of benefit to people. And then there's the opposite to that, which is non-maleficence. And what non-maleficence is making sure that it's not causing any harm to anybody. The most important part of ethics is demonstrating it. We will take those four areas into consideration when deciding whether something is the right thing to do.
Sorry, there was one really big non-related corporation that said they would do no harm, and we all know how that went.
Right, exactly. Yeah, ethics. Anyone talking about ethics around this stuff makes me incredibly nervous. But let's just be honest, right? Let's have a little look at this guy. Because this was comical to me when I saw it pop up. Given I've actually worked with Genomics England. I've met with their senior leadership team about 3 years ago a couple of times. So I understand what's going on inside there. And this guy's there running ethics. And he basically looks like some kind of 1970s school teacher type person, doesn't he? He's got a small wooden creature living in his beard there. He's actually wearing nail polish. Right. I mean, what's this all about? This is formal communication from Genomics England through their official channels. And this guy's got 3-week-old nail polish. I was actually hoping Charles was going to be here because he could have done an inspection because I bet his shoes aren't polished either. Yeah, and that shirt doesn't look particularly well ironed, although I don't think I could talk because mine's not looking great today. But what was he talking about? Anyway, let's not just deal with ad homs, right? We're going to actually dig into what he said. And the first thing he jumped out at me is that he's talking about equity. This is a Marxist concept, right? This is equal outcomes, right? So this guy is a Marxist running ethics for this organization. He talked about autonomy and consent, which is frankly laughable in the context of what the NHS has been doing for the past few years. Beneficence, non-maleficence. I mean, again, let's just roll it into what we said about consent. Yeah, they've been harming people. So the idea that this fella is going to stop them from harming people is absolutely laughable. And then there was a little bit at the end there that was missed out where he says that the most important thing about being ethical is demonstrating that you're ethical. Whereas I actually think that being ethical is the most important thing about being ethical. But anyway.
Yes. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking about that in extra too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Debbie, we'll end with you then. And what's the latest from Cornwall?
Well, I've got lots to say about Cornwall, actually. We'll talk more about it in extra. But if you're thinking of coming to Cornwall for a holiday this summer, coming to see the Eden Project, you might have a surprise because they're talking about taxing tourists coming into Cornwall. And actually, they're going to tax them probably coming into Devon as well to make sure that they don't ever get to Cornwall. So, yeah, watch this space. And if you want to come and see a new species of jumping spider, we've got one of those as well.
Okay, Debbie, thank you very much. Thank you very much to Ben as well. And thank you for all joining us today. It's been a fun program. We will be back in a few minutes for some extra. Hope everyone has a great weekend, whether you're joining us for extra or not. And we will see you at 1 p.m. as usual on Monday. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.